I in 1988. Our daughter, Elizabeth, had been born while we were living in an apartment in Brooklyn, and we felt that it was time for a place of our own. I had also been working long enough on staff at Newsweek to have gotten the sense that they weren't likely to fire me anytime soon. We learned that buyers were pushing into neighborhoods they might not have considered a few years earlier, earning the label of gentrifiers. Since Jean and I hadn't come to New York City accompanied by trust funds, we would join them. I was talking with colleagues about starting our search, and one of them said, "You have to come see my building. I have the best apartment in Manhattan." We did visit. He lived at 790 Riverside Drive, up at 157th Street, at the southern end of Washington Heights. The building was a bizarre behemoth, 12 stories tall and sitting on a circle. Its name was the Riviera. It had a grand, if run down, marble lobby. My friend's co-op apartment was on a high floor, and it was nearly a city block long, facing out toward the Hudson with a sweeping view of the George Washington Bridge. At street level, the neighborhood seemed vibrant and somewhat sketchy. The drug dealers working the corner near the subway stop at the corner of 157th and Broadway were brazen. Caribbean music was playing on the street, and the mood of the building seemed relaxed. We loved it. We had been shown one dark, airless Upper West Side apartment after another within our price range, when a realtor opened the door to one of the available co-ops at 790 RSD. The hallway stretched more than 50 feet ahead of us. To the right was a high-ceilinged living room and a dining room, separated by French doors. There were 3 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms. It seemed like an impossible amount of space for Manhattan. And we could have it for a little less than $140,000. It wasn't on a high floor. Instead of the river and the bridge view my colleague upstairs had, we'd be looking out on the street oval and the surrounding buildings, which were old and stately. Even that view, however, could be glimpsed only from a single window in our bedroom and another one in what would become Elizabeth's. The big windows in the long living and dining rooms faced one of the deep air shafts that gave the building an odd, folded look. Jean and I thought about Elizabeth, who would be walking soon. We imagined her running down that long hallway and playing in the enormous, for New York, living room. We had saved enough to make the down payment, helped by an $8,000 inheritance that Jean had received when her grandfather died. But staying there looked as if it could become very expensive. Mortgages were pricey at the time. The average 30-year fixed mortgage rate was more than 10%, and the country was in the middle of a brutal spike. We signed up for an adjustable-rate mortgage with an introductory rate that, for the time, seemed reasonable, something around 7% for the first 5 years. Or was it 9? I don't remember. The point was that it got us in the door. We did worry about what might happen after 5 years. If interest rates kept rising, we could be laddering up by 2 points each year, with ruinously expensive payments on top of the maintenance fees for the building. We hoped that before the fixed rate period expired, we would have moved on. My hands were shaking as Jean and I signed the endless succession of closing documents. But I knew that it was time to take our place among grown-ups, that we had to own our home. Or something like a home. It was unclear. What had we just bought? We had grown up in houses in Texas. This was a co-op, which we hadn't even heard of before coming to New York, where they are common. It wasn't a condominium, which would have been treated by the law as a real property. What we had put our life savings and much of my future income into, apparently, were shares in a corporation that owned the building. What the mortgage broker had called a mortgage was actually more like a loan to pick up the shares and what's called the proprietary lease. The building, which was undergoing conversion from rentals to co-ops, was made up partly of renters and partly of owners. We still didn't own land, so by the Simcha Kravitz standard, we had not graduated beyond nobody. And we were so far uptown that people joked we lived in upstate Manhattan. To us, though, we had arrived at home. Our joy was short-lived. We were on our way to discovering that you actually can go wrong in real estate. The first problem to make itself known was noise. There was a lot of it. Music that is charming in the afternoon tends to lose its appeal after midnight. That air shaft amplified and resonated every note. One especially loud night, I walked up a few flights of stairs to find a party that was blasting dance numbers through the air shaft at a time when bars were required to close up for the night. A young woman I didn't know opened the door. "It's my birthday," she said by way of explanation. I asked her to turn down the music a little. She looked confused. "It's my birthday." The neighbors immediately upstairs from us were also loud, with music that pounded through the ceiling. It was odd, though. The music would stop and start. Phrases would repeat. Songs did not seem to begin or end. What we did not know when we'd bought the place was that they operated a recording studio in their living room. On our previous visits, the studio had not been active. When the musicians were working, the bass thudded through the ceiling and up and down the air shaft. It was hard to even talk over the noise. The owner of the apartment was a well-known keyboard artist and vocalist, Tunde Ra'alim. He and his twin brother had worked with Jimi Hendrix, Rick James, and others. We'd have been honored to have such a respected musician as a neighbor if he wasn't shaking the fillings out of our teeth day and night. A knock on their door and a request for a little quiet would get a friendly hello at least at first, but would only occasionally produce the desired result, and my suggestion that they could use headphones in the evening went nowhere. When I told colleagues about the noise, they nodded sagely. When we were considering buying the place, why hadn't I demanded to come back to the apartment after 10 p.m. so that we could tell whether there would be a lot of noise? I had no answer for them. Unlike my friends, I am neither perfect nor a genius. Besides, the brothers were running the studio at all hours. We had simply not visited while they were working. Noise wasn't the only problem with our upstairs neighbors. They did not supervise their kids well. When the children got bored, they would throw things into the toilets and flush them, sending water down into our bathroom and ruining the paint that we and a group of friends had so carefully applied when we moved in. We had coated the walls with new latex paint to seal in what could be found underneath. Decades of previous coats, dating back before the ban on the use of lead. If you broke off an ancient paint drip, the cross-section looked like multicolored tree rings. It was beautiful, but many of those interior layers bore toxic lead. A neighbor used heat guns to strip the paint off every wood surface, but we weren't willing to try that with our growing daughter in the house and more kids on the way. While we were living in Washington Heights, our boy Sammy came along. Blonde, solidly built, and full of life, Sam learned to walk in that apartment. Walk isn't the right word. He ran, starting out by standing up, lowering his big toddler head until he began to tip over, and blasting forward to stay upright. Setting a pattern of heedless fun that I hope he never outgrows, he would keep going until he slammed into a wall or a piece of furniture, or one of us. Then he'd get up, laughing. We started calling him the Salmonator. So now we had two children in Washington Heights. It was an interesting neighborhood. Yes, the drug dealers worked the corner up at Broadway, and their lookouts, who we learned were called Chi-Chi men, tried to get our attention as we crossed the street from the 157th Street subway station. But they were easygoing and didn't mind when I'd wave them off. Maybe they were why our block got a lot of attention from police. One day, Jean noticed that the ground floor window in a building up 157th was papered over, but with a strip missing. She could see men moving back and forth inside. They were clearly staking out a building across the street. We hoped nothing involving arrests and gunplay would happen while we were heading home after picking the kids up at their schools. We'd let them run down the length of the block to our building's door And what if they stumbled into the middle of a raid? We were spared that, at least. Even as we grew more comfortable with the neighborhood, others seemed to think we didn't fit in. One evening, coming out of the subway station, a white cop stopped me. He clearly thought I was headed into the neighborhood to score drugs. I explained to the officer that I only wanted to get home to my apartment. "You live here?" he asked, incredulous and scornful. Many of the city's police officers lived a ways upstate, in towns like Middletown, and they did not seem very comfortable on the streets of Washington Heights. The officer had his opinion, and we had ours. Washington Heights was, in many ways, the friendliest neighborhood I've ever lived in. Heavily African-American and Dominican, with remnants of old Irish and Jewish communities, it was accepting even of this little family of cracker gentrifiers. On weekends, I take the kids up to Coral Donut, a small diner at the corner of 158th and Broadway, for eggs and pancakes, and, of course, donuts. It was a treat, just Dad and the guys. On our way back downhill to the Oval, Elizabeth loved to stop in to say hi to Gary, who ran the dry-cleaning place. The little fried chicken stand across Broadway had tasty eats that we loved for a quick snack, at least until we all got food poisoning one time and decided that we could fry our own chicken. Sometimes things got a little too lively outside. Cars would occasionally pull up around the Riverside Oval in the middle of the night and play their stereos at top volume. It was loud enough to wake us several floors up, and, more important, wake the kids. I started keeping an old egg on the windowsill. One night, when a car sat outside too long and too loudly, I opened the window, slid the screen up, tossed the aged egg down the five stories, and slammed the window shut before impact. My aim was decent. We heard the squeal of the tires racing toward Broadway. It was briefly satisfying, but I didn't try that trick again. Instead, we found ways to cope with the noise. When we bought a window air conditioner, we asked the salesman for the loudest model he had. It wasn't a request he heard often, but he knew what units got the most complaints. Soon we had plenty of white noise that helped us get through the nights. We had settled in. Then, in the summer of 1992, Washington Heights exploded. A police officer shot and killed Jose Garcia, a 23-year-old immigrant from the Dominican Republic and a father of two. Some 40 square blocks of Washington Heights erupted into rioting, with scores of injuries and arrests, and trash cans and cars set afire. We had been visiting relatives in Texas for the July 4th weekend when all this started and had missed the news. Jean had stayed in Houston an extra day with Elizabeth, and I'd flown back with Sam. A cab took us home from the airport, coming down Riverside and avoiding the mess on Broadway. The subject of riots didn't come up during the ride. All I noticed was that the streets seemed awfully quiet. We got home and then came back downstairs at about 10 p.m. to run out for milk and groceries for the next day. At the entryway, I encountered a group of residents standing around the lobby, looking grim. I headed past them toward the door, and they stopped me. "Hey, hey, hey! Don't you know what's been going on out there?" "Well, no," I said. "I'd been away." They explained, with the patience reserved for explaining things to dim children, that they were standing there to head off any trouble from the rioters who had been rioting, and how could I not have heard about the riots? "I would be crazy," they continued to explain, "to walk outside with my son." "Well," I said, "I'd rather face rioters than have a hungry boy in the morning. I at least needed some milk." Bobby, a tall, skinny guy who was always friendly, said he'd take me up to Broadway to find an open bodega. We left Sam with the guardians in the lobby. He was a sound sleeper, that boy, and walked up together. The streets were quiet. The rioters had cleared out by then, but they had left behind trash-scattered streets and burning cars, their flames tinted with blues and oranges and greens from the various plastics used to make them. It was, I have to say, beautiful. but I didn't spend a lot of time admiring the view. Bobby and I made our way across Broadway, because he'd noticed that a metal shutter on one bodega was not pulled all the way down, or locked. The man had good eyes. He banged on the shutter. The people inside raised it enough for me to see that there were several of them there, behind the plexiglass panel of the door, and that they had baseball bats. I pleaded for some help in my middling Spanish. "Necesito leche para mi bebé," I shouted. They opened the door, let me in, sold me the milk. I thanked Bobby and offered him a 10, which he took with thanks. "See you, man," he said, and headed down Broadway, leaving me to make my way back to our building alone. Note to self, next riot, pay Bobby after he walks you back to the apartment building. I got back without incident and thanked the men for taking on babysitting Sam while guarding the building. He'd slept through my riot. I took him back upstairs and put him in bed. Over our time at 790, our biggest problem turned out to be our next-door neighbors. There was a matriarch and several of her kids and their kids, all living in a four-bedroom apartment. One of the brothers, Arnold, was well over 6 feet tall and powerfully, if heavily, built. He worked hard and seemed to be supporting the extended family on his income. He could be friendly and had a ready smile, but any complaint about, say, noise? They blasted their stereos and their video games at all hours, turned him cold and occasionally threatening. The other brother, Charlie, was small and thin and clearly smart, but he was troubled. Though I have no medical training and an actual diagnosis is beyond my abilities, it didn't take long to figure out that he suffered from a mental illness. Some days he would dress nattily. At other times he was unwashed and unkempt, moving in a fog. Asked how he was, he might say, "I'd be okay if they didn't keep putting that stuff in the air." I would agree that the stuff in the air was hard to deal with. On one good day, he hung art posters in the hallway next to our apartments. A couple of weeks later, they were gone. I asked why he had taken them down, and he explained, "John, the pictures had started talking to me." I agreed that it could be very difficult when the pictures start talking to you. Even at his most tormented, he was pleasant. Although people in the building told us he exposed himself to women in the elevators, he treated Jean with courtesy and respect. Jean told me that she figured it was because he always saw her with a child, but we were grateful, whatever the reason. Their mother lived in the apartment, too. She had friendly days, but, like Charlie, she had moments when sanity seemed to leave her, and she'd tell us about black helicopters. One day she poked her head out the door as I was walking by. "Freddy Krueger! Freddy Krueger!" she shouted, wild-eyed. I didn't know why she was saying the name of the killer from the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, and didn't ask. The apartment was taking a toll on Sammy. It was too dark, too confining despite its spaciousness, and too loud. One afternoon, when Arnold and his friends stood out on the elevator landing, laughing and joking at top volume, Sam, with the voice far deeper than a toddler should be, shouted, "Shut up! Shut up!" loud enough to be heard through the door. Arnold probably thought it was me. Jean had noticed that Sammy was becoming unhappy in New York. She'd asked him what was wrong, and he'd simply say, "I'm sad." He'd wanted something more than an air shaft to look out at. Tensions continued to grow between Arnold and me. One evening, we ended up standing together at the elevator landing, waiting for our ride to the lobby. He had a friend with him. Arnold gave me a smile that was anything but friendly. He pulled out a paint scraper, the kind with a razor blade on the business end. "I'm going to cut you, John," he said. His eyelids were low. He seemed a little buzzed. The friend said nervously, "Come on, Arnold. That's not cool." Trying to keep my voice steady, I asked, "Arnold, are you seriously threatening me?" "John, nah. You know, I'm just messing with you," he said. I told him I wasn't so sure. He put the blade away, still smiling that unfriendly smile. We made good friends in the building as well. Pam, an around-the-corner neighbor on our floor, was a single mom with an adorable daughter. We would sit and drink coffee while the girls played. A couple floors above us was a young couple raising a daughter in an apartment with the same floor plan as ours. The husband, who worked for the city, was the neighbor who labored every evening to remove old paint with a heat gun and a scraper. So we got a sense of just how beautiful these old apartments could be. And the neighborhood was adapting to us, at least a little. When crossing Broadway one evening after getting off the subway, one of the drug scouts stepped out to ask if I was looking to score.
"S-s-s,"
another lookout said, calling him back.
"He lives here."
It felt good. Even the dealers knew me. I thanked him and walked on. Making a move and feeling the squeeze. Then came change. Toward the end of 1992, the Washington Post announced an opening for a science writer. A friend from the Post told me that after my 8 years at Newsweek, "You really know what you're doing, but it seems to me that you're also bored." He was right. I applied. I was clearly unqualified for a science writing job, since many of the science writers I knew had majored in technical fields in college, and some had graduate degrees. But I had gained confidence at Newsweek, where I had also been unqualified to work as a business writer. The editor who had hired me for that gig scoffed when I told him I didn't know anything about business. He said, "Read a book." I sold my would-be new bosses on the idea that since the beat I was applying for was covering the Food and Drug Administration, my background as a business reporter and my legal training made me more qualified for the job than someone who knew only science. As for the science, I promised to read a book. To my astonishment, they bought the argument and hired me. Going to one of the world's great news organizations, the paper that uncovered Watergate, was exciting. But I'll admit, just between us, that part of what motivated me was the move away from that problematic apartment in New York. We had learned a few things from living at 790 Riverside Drive. While we had lived in apartments all over Austin and in our early years in New York, the density of the city meant that any problems we encountered were magnified. We had been naive. We hadn't understood the fundamentals of real estate. Gene summed up how we'd screwed up in buying that first home. We'd fallen for what amounted to a real estate Ponzi scheme. She said recently, reminiscing, "Our mistake was letting other people tell us what financial decisions we should make with our money," referring to the colleague who had sold us on the idea of living in his building. We figured that since they had sunk all of their money into something, it would be safe for us to do the same. We assumed that they had taken the trouble to assess the risks and the likelihood that their investment would pay off in the end, even make them money. In other words, being afraid of money had hurt us, and we'd substituted the judgment of others for our own. But, she said, it was worse than that. She believed that the other buyers who enthusiastically invited us in knew how shaky the building and the neighborhood were. We thought that we were being advised by trustworthy people, when in fact they were using us to validate their own choices. They had bought into this building and could recoup their loss only if they convinced other gullible people to buy in as well. They were trying to create a climate of excitement about this neighborhood, but the neighborhood itself was resistant to change, she said. Ultimately, somebody made a lot of money off our apartment, but it wasn't us, and it was never going to be us. We also hadn't understood ourselves. We now know that it was essential to get the feel of a place and its neighborhood before buying. We had also realized that we weren't cut out to be, as Gene put it, clueless urban pioneers. Our next place, we decided, would be a standalone house. No more shared walls, so that we and our neighbors wouldn't be so much in each other's business, and that our kids needed space. The stress of living at 790 Riverside stayed with me a long time, too. For years afterward, whenever I saw a loaf of bread with the brand name Arnold, common in the Northeast, I'd feel a flash of resentment toward my old neighbor. As good as that bread looks, I've never been able to bring myself to buy a loaf. What we didn't know when we left Washington Heights was that we weren't escaping our problems. We were digging ourselves in deeper. My new salary at the Washington Post was comparable to the old one, with one sweetener. The Post offered me an extra $900 a month for the better part of my first year with them to help defray, but not cover, the cost of the mortgage and maintenance on the New York apartment. The thinking was that would be more than enough time to sell the place. But in the spring of 1993, New York housing was in the midst of a multi-year slump that made even our bargain apartment look overpriced. Prices had dropped, and the high tide that washed would-be gentrifiers northward into Washington Heights had receded, leaving us with a much smaller number of buyers willing to look as far uptown as 157th Street. So, we decided to rent it out. After all, we might come back someday, right? And if we held on to it, prices might turn around. We hired a broker who would serve as our property manager, and she found somebody for the first year we lived in Washington. A doctor with the city health department, and a good guy. He let us know that the upstairs was still raining into our apartment now and then, but was otherwise unperturbed by anything else going on around him. After the 9 months of supplemental pay from the Post ran out, we were losing money every month on the difference between our tenant's rent and the cost of the mortgage. Worse, the broker told me, in the current market, our apartment was almost worthless. The owners of the building had sold only a quarter of the apartments in the building, far less than most banks' threshold for selling a mortgage. Banks didn't want to take a chance on a building whose co-op structure might collapse. Even if you have somebody who has cash, they won't be able to sell it, she explained. But then, wonder of wonders, the upstairs neighbors moved out. With that little problem out of the way, our tenant showed an interest in buying the apartment. He had a catch, however. Since getting a new mortgage would be next to impossible, he wanted to assume the current mortgage. We were willing to transfer it without making any profit on the deal, just to be out from under the apartment. But the bank refused. Co-op mortgages, they told him, are not assumable. The good doctor moved out. The next renter looked almost as good as our doctor had, at least on paper. The broker told me that he made $58,000 a year working with a marketing group and that he had a clean credit record and a good job. The credit record showed that he had no credit cards. A quirk, but not necessarily a red flag. Maybe he was just trying to avoid debt, she explained. He was in his 20s and raised in New York. I feel okay about him, she said. He moved in. And that's when things went from financially stressful to nightmarish. Before a year had passed, the tenant, let's call him Mr. V, fell behind on his rent. I'd call, and he'd give me excuses, but the checks never came. Anything could happen, he told me. Maybe it got lost in the mail? Tomorrow I'm going to Federal Express your check for February, he said in March. It's in the mail. Jean checked the mailbox every day, and day after day she'd give me the report. No check from V, as expected, she wrote in an email. No letter from V. No check from V. Call V and see what's going on. The February check came at the end of March. By May, there was no check for April or May. I looked at a copy of one of his checks, which had his bank account number on it. In a move that just might have been a teensy bit illegal, I called his bank's automated account line and punched in the numbers to find out his balance. It was $26.03. Each month, our savings were being drained away to pay off a mortgage on an apartment that we couldn't sell and which we weren't getting rent money from. In August 1995, I hired a lawyer and terminated the lease. I called V and told him to get out. He responded that he knew his rights as a New York tenant and that he would be in no rush to leave. "I'll be hearing fucking Christmas bells before I'm out of here," he said. He was at least partly right. New York had laws to protect tenants that flowed from horrifying abuses by landlords over the generations. And now I was the landlord. He also told me that he had mafia connections and that I shouldn't mess with him. I was 38 and facing financial ruin. One day, about that time, I was talking with the superintendent of the building, Nika, about my problems with getting the tenant out. He asked me a simple question.
"You want me to kill him?"
Nika was a Serb, having emigrated from somewhere in the former Yugoslavia. He gave the impression that this task was not outside his skill set. Okay, I do have to admit that it was tempting. Briefly. The tenant had taken our always precarious financial situation and turned it into a dumpster fire. I paused.
Listener,
I did not have him killed. Nika, I said slowly into the phone. No. I paused again, whether for emphasis or simply trying to catch my breath. I do not want you to kill him. I mean it. Listen to me. I am not saying no and hoping you'll kill him or even break his arm. Don't do anything to him. I mean it.
Okay,
he said, sounding bored. Instead of killing my tenant, I called the lawyer about getting him out. He walked me through the process of eviction, pointing out the many ways that my tenant could get the court to grant delays, and more delays. And even if I got through the whole process, you'll have a judgment for money, but it will be worthless. If I drove from Washington to New York City and attempted what he delicately called self-help, I could be in for huge damages. Judges just don't like that at all. So much for rethinking Nika's offer. The lawyer had straightforward advice. He told me to give up on the money the jerk owed me. Bite the inside of your cheek and call him and say, "If you get out by the 14th, I will sign a piece of paper saying I will never go against you for the rent." He got a little fatherly. "You're giving away $6,000, but you're not really giving away $6,000. You're not going to get it." He was right. I wrote up the letter and called V. He agreed to go. By then, I was also talking occasionally to the tenant's boss, a guy named Art. He, too, seemed mystified by his employee. "I think he really does come from a mafia family," he said. He said V owed him money, too. He offered his wisdom about New York landlord-tenant law. "What the law says is, fuck the landlord and give the tenant all the rights he does not deserve." When we ended the call, I couldn't help wondering if I hadn't just been talking to V, who was having a good laugh over yet another deception. I was doubting my sanity. V was out by the end of August, leaving a mess behind. He had spray-painted graffiti on several walls and left behind piles of clothes, garbage, and debris. But we cleaned up and soon had another tenant, a nice couple whose credit record looked terrific. Within a few months, however, the couple broke up. The husband left, and the wife told me she could not pay the rent. She agreed to move out. Our savings account, which had been a point of pride to me, had long been drained. We had no faith in our ability to find another tenant. We had no idea what to do. We were struggling, but we also needed a place to call our own in the Washington area. When we'd first moved to town, Jean and I had found a rental house in Tacoma Park, Maryland, on the northeast edge of the District of Columbia. Tacoma Park is an environmentally friendly suburb with a historically lefty bent. People joked about it being the People's Republic of Tacoma Park. The racially mixed town had a sweet, relaxed vibe. It had a fun toy store, reasonably decent pizza, and a small place, Mark's Kitchen, that could turn out excellent grilled cheese sandwiches, and Korean bulgogi. It was unlike any place we'd ever lived, and it felt like home. Parts of Tacoma Park slopped over into D.C., and part of it overlapped from Montgomery County to Prince George's County. It was hilly and full of trees, with beautiful old buildings and nice homes. The old wood frame place we rented there was comfy, with a big sunny bedroom upstairs that looked out over the backyard. We had brought a washer and dryer. There was no room for it on our floor. The landlord let us set them up in the basement, which had once been cut up into three apartments, but was now a stripped ruin with floors that flooded with the slightest rain. We elevated the washer and dryer on boards, dropped some more boards on the floor to help us cross over the puddles, and we were in business. The owner also had an apartment in the attic that was vacant, and it ended up being rented by a Texas friend who was no more picky about his accommodations than we were. As nice as our new life was, and I loved my job as a science writer with the Washington Post, and our Tacoma Park neighbors were relaxed and fun to talk with, we had no money. We had none of what the economists call discretionary income, anyway. Continuing to pay the mortgage and maintenance on the New York City place had, to use a term I'd heard from a corporate bankruptcy expert I once interviewed about Enron, bageled our savings. Somehow, Gene made it work, keeping long lists of sums in a notebook, scribbling down the bills and what we had to pay first and how to make the most of each paycheck. She would wake up on payday, look at the amount for that week, which varied with expense reimbursements, pay for vacation days worked, and the like, and tell me, "I spent all your money," or, "We have $115 until next Thursday." We plan our grocery shopping accordingly. That's when I started buying French fries with gravy at the Post cafeteria. I could have brought food in from home, but I found that even more depressing. Something about soggy sandwiches in a baggie breaks my heart. And with a fair amount of Tabasco, fries with gravy are pretty good. But there were other belt-tightening measures that hurt. One year, when our temple held its Purim carnival, we had only enough cash to buy a few tickets for each of our kids to play the games. Other children were running wild. Our guys had to pick their shots and make a few careful choices. It wasn't something I'd wanted my children to have to do. And let's face it, it's not like going hungry. But in a place where the kids around them could do whatever they wanted, buy what they wanted, get what they wanted, my guys knew that in our family, there wasn't quite enough. We could not go on that way. Our parents, including my father-in-law, a professor of property law, said that it was time to file for bankruptcy and get out from under our New York City burden. The prospect left me desolate. It felt to me as if the idea of being bankrupt would put the stamp of failure on everything Gene and I had done and tried until then. Career? Pretty good, but that bankruptcy would overshadow it, I thought, recalling a former boss who suddenly left his job as an editor at the Wall Street Journal shortly before filing for bankruptcy. That story had even been in the newspapers. I wasn't working in his league, but the possibility that going bust might cloud my future couldn't be dismissed. Yet there was still no way to sell the apartment, and no way to make enough money to pay for everything we were dealing with. The Tacoma Park House, getting smarter. Before we did something that could have such an enormous impact on our financial record, however, Gene and I decided that we needed to make one more try at buying a house. Once burned, twice shy? Sure. But we had to consider a window that was closing on us, and fast. If we did have to file for bankruptcy, it would wreck our credit. It would be a very long time before we could buy a house again. If we were able to buy and then had to declare bankruptcy, we would be protected under homestead exemptions. It would be unlikely that creditors could force us to sell the house to pay off debts. And, as people in financial trouble go, we were still in surprisingly good shape. We had a decent income and no other debts to speak of, aside from the apartment and the balance of several thousand dollars on our credit card. We were paying our bills on time. So That left a question. Could we swing a house purchase? It turned out that we could, as long as we kept things cheap. We started looking, but without really pushing. One day, as I was walking along Elm Avenue, about a block from our house, I saw a for sale sign in front of a 1920s brick bungalow. The yard was overgrown, and the shed at the end of the gravel driveway was rotting away and leaning toward a slow-motion collapse. But the house looked solid, at least from the outside. I wrote down the number of the realtor, who was from a small local company. The line separating two Maryland counties crosses Elm. The house was listed as being in Prince George's County, though it seemed to me to be barely within the line for Montgomery County. This was a big deal. Prince George's County schools were not as well regarded as Montgomery County schools, and so a lot of buyers would not be interested in a house on the Prince George's side of the line. Because of that, PG houses also tended to cost less than MoCo homes. I called the realtor, and Jean and I set up a tour. The visit was not auspicious. Letting us in by way of a side entrance, the realtor scraped her heel against the bottom edge of the closing screen door and suffered an ugly cut. She was in pain and limping as she showed the place. The previous owners had left the house a mess. It had gone unpainted for years, and there was a deep burn on the dining room floor and peeling linoleum on the kitchen floor. Worse, the owners had pulled a fridge from the wall, an antique model that ran on natural gas, and left it there with rotting food sealed inside. The stench was eye-watering. The basement had a number of larger rooms, but there was evidence of water damage and dislodged floor tiles, and an ancient boiler that looked less like a heating system than a bomb from a 1950s sci-fi movie. The realtor, still bleeding, nearly begged us to leave. She insisted that she had plenty of other listings. But I loved it on sight. What I saw was a home with beautiful wood floors and detailed plasterwork in every downstairs room. We would later learn that the original owner had been a plaster craftsman, and we could find his masterful work in the local bank and elsewhere. The rooms were not large, but were cozy. The main bedroom downstairs was barely big enough for our king bed, but we knew we could make it work. The upstairs bedroom seemed perfect for the kids. The room we knew would be Elizabeth's had sweet curves in the ceiling where the room was framed in under the angles of the roof. The back bedroom looked out directly into trees, a perfect place for Sam, the boy who loved to look out on green things, to make his own. But Sammy had to be convinced. I showed the house to him, and he was upset. "Dad, don't buy this house," he pleaded. "It stinks." I did some checking and realized that the place really was in Montgomery County after all, which meant that the kids would stay in the Tacoma Park schools they had enjoyed for the year we'd been living there. We hired our own broker, Patricia, to represent us. The sellers were elderly brothers and sisters. Their father had lived in the place until he died, and they wanted to be rid of it without doing more work. They had homes of their own. The asking price was more than $200,000, low for the neighborhood, but not for a house in such bad shape. I offered $150,000. "Are you sure?" Patricia asked, questioning whether the offer was insulting and might destroy any chance of negotiation. "Please, try it," I asked. They came back with a counteroffer, $160,000. Startled by our success, we scrambled to figure out how to pull together a down payment. Our savings were gone, but we did have money in that 401k, which had been growing since 1986 and had more than $100,000 in it. The last thing I wanted to do was to break into that piggy bank, but the opportunity was too good to pass up. With a little research, I found out it would be expensive money. The government charges a 10% penalty for withdrawing money from your 401k account before you reach retirement age. But we agreed, sitting in our sagging rental house a couple of blocks away, we might never catch a deal like this again. We signed the pieces of paper, got together the down payment of $15,000, and bought the little house on Elm. People in the neighborhood later told me they were furious with us for lowering the average sale price in the neighborhood by so much. Comparable homes nearby were selling for twice as much. But our neighbors hadn't smelled that refrigerator. Before we moved in, we found a handyman who worked with us for several weeks to fix the place up a bit and paint the walls. The old bad smells departed. But some problems persisted. The previous owner had been a smoker and had spent much of his time smoking in the downstairs bathroom. The walls were stained with yellowish tar residue from all those cigarettes. We cleaned and painted. But for the next 5 years, any time somebody took a particularly long, hot shower that steamed up the room, the residue would once again seep through the paint. We painted two more times, but it still happened. So that sometimes gave the house a kind of Amityville Horror sensibility. The handyman was the kind of guy who, when he did tree work, would send his assistant, Pedro, scurrying up the tree with a roaring chainsaw and little protection. I stayed home to watch the work, staring fretfully out the back window at what I was sure would be a sickening plunge, with mid-air amputation followed by evisceration and a death-ensuring splat for a grand finale. "If you're going to get scared," Owen chided me, "don't look." Nothing tragic happened to Pedro. The two men knew their business, and the house shaped up bit by bit. There were good surprises, too. The woodwork in the living room turned out to be American chestnut, a wood largely wiped out before the turn of the 20th century by a blight. It is rare today. The handsome slate roof, while old, was still in decent shape. We found 1950s-style formica for the kitchen counters with a boomerang pattern, which made the room silly and glorious. This house looked like all our dreams. I had walked my father through when we first bought it, and again after the cleanup was done. He looked at the chestnut banister and the amazing plaster, the light coming through the newly cleaned windows, and the comfortable proportions of the rooms. "I knew it was a good house," he told me. "I didn't know it was going to be a beautiful house." Even beautiful houses have problems, of course. Cracks worked their way up the walls and into that beautiful plaster. Eventually, we would discover that the foundation was settling poorly, and we'd have to shore up one corner and patch. And the basement, which was only partly finished, got damp after any heavy rain. Water would spill into the utility room down there in the fall through a side door, because an outside drain quickly clogged with leaves. Whenever it rained, I would have to step outside in the cold, soaking wet, often in the middle of the night, often in my underwear, to clear leaves away from that drain and prevent the flooding, or at least keep it from getting worse. Over time, we would spend large amounts on new drains and waterproofing, and would learn terms like French drain and parging. It was troublesome, but we dearly loved the place. When we needed new rain gutters to draw rainwater away from the house, I sprang for copper. They cost more, but were bigger than the standard 6-inch gutters that are extruded from a truck, which meant that they'd catch more. But really, it's that they looked perfect against the slate. Other neighborhood dads walked by to watch the shiny half-rounds being installed with admiration and a kind of gutter lust. Those snazzy overpriced gutters were my midlife convertible, an extravagance of vanity. How did we pay for projects to repair our crumbling personal infrastructure? Much of it was possible because of a book I co-wrote that came out in 2000. The advance was tens of thousands of dollars, delivered in 3 installments. And each installment went straight into one of the kids' mouths for orthodontia, into the ground for the foundation repair and waterproofing, or into those gutters. The money didn't lift us out of debt, but it kept our hole, the financial one, not the one that the very expensive workers dug around the house for the French drain and parging, from getting deeper. And there we lived, cheerily, for 5 years. Our youngest child, Joseph, was born during our stay on Elm Avenue. The kids turned the house into their playground. One day, Sam and some friends figured out a game. Rolling down the stairs in a wire-frame laundry basket. They left a weird pattern of dings in that lovely wood. This initially enraged me. What is this going to do to the resale value? And later made me laugh. A house is not a Fabergé egg. It gets used. In 2000, our stay in Tacoma Park came to an end. The New York Times came calling with the offer of a job writing about technology. It was time to move again. Patricia, the realtor who had helped us buy the house for $160,000, sold it for $305,000. The buyer really liked those gutters. Finally, it seemed, we were doing this house thing right. We nearly doubled our money and made more selling that house than we'd lost on the New York apartment. Its value is still climbing. I just checked Zillow. That little house on Elm is worth more than $700,000 today. Back to New York, or rather, New Jersey. The call from the Times came as a shock, but a happy one. The technology editor liked my stuff, and, over lunch in Washington's old Ebbett Grill, asked if I'd like to come work for him. I could not imagine saying no, and flew to New York not long after for a gantlet of job interviews. At the end of the day, I met Joseph Lelleveld, the executive editor. A quietly brilliant man who won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting in South Africa. He also had a reputation for personal awkwardness, which, I was warned, would make our conversation difficult. That was not a problem for us. We had a lively conversation. It turned out we both adored Ann Richards, the former Texas governor. I had written my first cover story for the Texas Observer about Richards when she was state treasurer. He had gotten to know her on a days-long Texas rafting trip that sounded raucous and hellaciously fun. Somehow, he told me, they'd ended up wearing each other's T-shirts. I've wanted to ask him about that ever since. When he asked me the interview question I hate the most, what do you see yourself doing in 10 years? A question that invites you to talk about your desire to run the place someday, I answered honestly, if I'm lucky, writing. It's all I've ever wanted to do. And I'm pretty good at it. I think this is the place that can help me get better. As we were ending the interview, he asked whether I had any questions. I told him that I had no idea how, if I got the job, I could ever afford to live in the New York area again. He listened politely and then gathered up a few real estate sections with recent editions of the column, If You're Thinking of Living in... with descriptions of towns around New York. He smiled and said, As you're walking out through the newsroom, look around you. All of these people live here. It was a great pitch, and cleverly elided the fact that most of those people had come to the city years before. If I got the job, we would be trying to enter a hot real estate market. Kevin, the editor who was trying to hire me, told me that Mr. Lelleveld had enjoyed the interview as much as I had. He offered me the job at 10% more than my Washington Post salary, with a small signing bonus as a sweetener. I was torn and carefully considered whether I could stretch our already tight budget to meet our new circumstances. I'm joking. I took the job. Leapt for the job. How could I not? It was the New York freaking Times. As good as it gets for people like me. The New York Times put us up in a hotel in Morristown, New Jersey, while we took a couple of days to look for houses. A relocation specialist helped me figure out that we were likeliest to settle in New Jersey. What had we learned from our previous homes? A few things. We had to be able to afford the house we were in. The public schools had to be good, and I needed a manageable commute, say, less than 45 minutes each way. That created a Venn diagram. Commute, schools, affordability. It sorted things out for us very quickly. The most likely towns were Milburn, Maplewood, and South Orange. All three sit near a handy commuter train line called the Midtown Direct, and all have well-regarded schools. The relocation specialist set us up with a high-energy broker who was efficient and insistent. We drove around with her for 2 days. At the end of the first day, having seen a fair number of houses, I felt that there was a problem with our tour. In setting it up, I had told the broker, Arlene, that we were not going to be able to afford a house that cost more than $400,000. But everything she showed us was $400,000 or more.
John, she said, you aren't going to be able to get a house that meets your standards in Millburn for less than $400,000.
Arlene, I replied, you have no idea how low my standards are. I asked her to hand me her stack of pages printed out from the multiple listing service and sorted them from least expensive to most expensive. There were a number of places with an asking price under $400,000 and even under $350,000. Each of the houses in our price range turned out to be close to the railroad track for the Midtown Direct, often enough adjacent to it. For Jean and me, the house hunt became a game. Nice house. Where's the railroad track? Oh, there it is, just over the backyard fence. The cheapest place in Arlene's stack was an unlovely 1950s split level on a busy street. The train tracks weren't in the backyard. This time, they were at the top of the street. This house was, literally, on the wrong side of the tracks. The MLS listing read, "Not a drive-by. Must see." Yes, that's how unattractive it was, with its bedrooms on three different landings and ugly metal awnings over the windows. But it had a sunny Florida room, an enclosed porch with big windows, and unfortunately signs of water damage to the wood, and a big backyard. Did I mention the house was painted pink? Pink like Pepto-Bismol? Kids on the block called it the Barbie house. In the hottest of hot real estate markets, it had gone unbought for about 5 months, and it was just $327,000, the least expensive place we'd seen in Millburn. It was, in other words, perfect. We bought the house and stayed in a corporate apartment for a few extra weeks while workers did the floors and freshened the paint on the walls. And we painted that pink exterior dark blue. The neighbors dropped by to thank us for the paint job. We were offered a 15-year mortgage, which allows you to pay down the debt while paying less interest and building equity in the house more quickly. But our rule on mortgages was simple. We wanted the lowest possible monthly payment. We were buying the most house we could and were always financially squeezed. So the 30-year fixed, with its more comfortable payments, was, for us, the way to go. This was the house that would do the most to change our lives for the better. In 2014, after 14 years there, we decided to sell. As I've mentioned, the move and its timing were Jean's idea. She had gotten a cold call from a real estate agent who said inventory was low and that our house might be worth $700,000, more than double what we paid for it. Our youngest, Joseph, was finishing high school. I had expected to sell the next year, once he was off at college. But this was the first hottish market after a long lull. When the real estate broker came to the house, she immediately dropped her estimate to $600,000. It was a big house, but not a charmer. Still, we decided to go ahead. The mortgage and property taxes on the place were costing us more than $2,200 each month. Interest payments on the college loans for our two older kids was about $1,000 each month. There were car payments and the stubborn balance on our credit card, which had been pressed into service to buy a new boiler, among other big-ticket emergencies that we hadn't had the cash for. And, of course, there were little things like groceries and gas. Jean had a part-time job with the police department as a crossing guard. It helped, but it wasn't enough. We were in trouble. "We're drowning," Jean told me. She said that she spent her time on the job running the numbers in her head, figuring out which bills could wait and which had to be paid, and it was getting harder to make the numbers line up at the end of each month. She was the one keeping our books. If she thought we were headed for disaster, it was time. And it sold, after a false start or two, not for $700,000, not for $600,000.